You're listening to the Outclassed podcast with Mike Redding and Blake Seifert, exploring excellence in teaching, tech, and leadership.
All right, excellent. Welcome back to the Outclassed podcast. Really looking forward to hanging out with you for a little bit today. And we're digging into the realm of digital citizenship today. We've got a special guest with us, Carla Sanders. Carla is from New Zealand. A bit of a disclaimer, she does some work for using technology better, but she also runs a not-for-profit called Sticks and Stones that do a lot of this work with students in the digital space. It's got quite a different take on how digital citizenship should happen in a school. So really looking forward to digging in and learning from you. Not sure, Carla, if you got the memo, but tonight's red wine night and I've got some nice red wine. I've got some nice French cheese and I'm ready to sit back and learn lots from you. We've also got Blake on the call today. Blake, how you going? Did I get you the memo around the red wine?
No, I didn't get the memo, Mike. I'm sitting here with my glass of water and no cheese, so I'm extremely disappointed.
That's payback for you being able to go get a haircut and me not being able to book one for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I know. Bit the bullet today, got my haircut. So apparently the stores are getting a bit more busy now, a bit more steady, the hairdresser was saying today. So we'll see where it goes. But obviously, you know, we're recording here at 19th of May. So when you hear this, it's probably, it will be in a very different place.
That's good. And schools went back in New Zealand yesterday. So the ministry reported yesterday that over 80% of students were back in class on day one, which it gives you a bit of an indication of where things are at, which is awesome. But as I mentioned, we've got Carla with us today. Carla runs Sticks for Stones. Carla, I'd love you to tell us a little bit about Sticks for Stones, how Sticks and Stones, how you got it going. Tell us a little bit about your backstory and a bit about who you are and what you do.
Totally. So it's quite embarrassing, which is awesome. So that's a really good chance for people to get to know me, isn't it? So I had this epically amazing idea that I was going to go into schools and change hearts and minds with all of my passion for student leadership. And I put together an idea about going in and running workshops. And then I sat down with some students that I had taught who were at high school now and said, hey, this is my idea and I'm really keen on your feedback. And they said it was a really shit idea. And when I asked them why, they said, because you're just going to be another grown-up coming and standing in an endless line of grown-ups telling us what not to do. And you have got no idea what it's like being a young person today. So with my fragile ego and tatters, I asked them, what would you do? And their question was, why are decisions always made about us without us? Why are we not involved from the beginning? And isn't it about time that our ideas, our expertise, our issues, we're going to be part of creating something a little bit different? So we rewrote the funding application that the government had provided some seed funding for. And we said very specifically that we will get students and that those students will create something new. And we don't know what it is, but we know it'll have a website and we know we'll run events and we know we'll create things. But apart from that, we don't know what it's going to be. So that was back in 2012. And in 2013, we had 30 teenagers from 5 different schools who volunteered to be part of something very different that they had no idea what it would be. And together we created Sticks and Stones. And that's everything from the name to our aims and goals and what we wanted to achieve. And adults find the name really hard. They are really challenged by it. They ask whether it's ironic. Not like the Alanis Morissette song, if you've got to explain why something could be ironic, then I guess it's not. But the whole reason was a 17-year-old who said, we don't want anything about bullying in our name. We want to be something that other young people can connect to. And we all know the rhyme. And we all know that words do hurt. And is it about time that we flipped that on its head and created something that took a different take? So that was how we got involved. I'd been home from a big overseas adventure for over 8 years. And didn't want to go back to a mainstream classroom. So this was another adventure to undertake rather than going back to full-time teaching.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's been great to watch it evolve on the sidelines. I think we probably met, when do you reckon that would have been, 2015-ish, thereabouts?
Yeah, I was looking at that. I think we met late 2014, 2015, which is when this kind of crazy idea that we thought would last for about a year was just starting to get some real traction and take shape in a way that we never could have imagined that it would have.
Yeah, it's been quite a testament too, to see, like, you've had Google get on board, you've had Facebook come on board, you've obviously had Ministry of Education funding. So you've had some big people who believe in your vision and help you roll that out around schools around New Zealand. So really, really keen to learn a little bit from you. One of the questions we get asked all the time is, well, I guess that maybe we should start. What just define digital citizenship? And is it just digital that you work in, or is there like an offline component to it?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the things that's huge for us. So when we talk about digital citizenship, that's not restricted to using technology or our time online. And we seem to talk about digital citizenship without putting a descriptor to it. Like, you can be a really crappy digital citizen. So what is it that we're hoping for? Is it a passport that you get from spending a certain amount of time online? So we need to think about what kind of digital citizen that we want to build. And for us, the key difference between having a positive digital experience and being a positive contributing digital citizen compared to focusing on cyber safety is it's not only about minimizing risk and staying safe, because if that's all we want, then what we allow to happen is an online space where we're not free to be ourselves without trolling and without harassment and without intense negativity that sort of moves away from what we want to achieve. So for us, digital citizenship transcends the online and offline. Young people do not make a distinction between online and offline. There is none of those awesome binary sounds that us old people are used to that would occur when we go online. And they seamlessly move between the two, and digital citizenship needs to seamlessly move between the two as well.
That's super interesting. I think that whole blurring of the lines is definitely where it's at. We see that a lot with students, where it's not necessarily do you feel more connected online or less connected, it's just connected, right? So
yeah,
I've definitely seen that with schools going to remote learning, and now schools coming back and students catching up and all of that works in there. So like, I'm interested, there's so many digital citizenship programs out there from all the, you know, different companies and so on. Like, how is your approach, apart from working with students, but like, can you maybe run through some of the elements that make it a little bit different to maybe what a school would think about in terms of, here's a policy, let's get the parents to sign off on a deployment piece of paper, we've done our digital citizenship, don't look at porn, be nice, don't bully, and we'll just block the hell out of everything. Like, what's your approach like in terms of where people usually sit in that scheme?
I think the biggest difference is that we think it evolves. And so the moment that you put a set of lesson plans on paper, or the moment that you polish off and print off a policy, it's changed. So we really think about digital citizenship as an evolving beast, for want of a better word. And I think the other thing for us that's critical is the role of social and emotional skills and confidence. So if we're asking people to be positive contributors into an online environment, but we're not giving them opportunities to take on perspectives of different people and to understand empathy and to be able to practice assertive responses when someone challenges them about something that they believe in or something about themselves, then we're not doing digital citizenship at all. So for us, the key difference between potentially traditional digital citizenship programs or lesson plans where it's, you know, choose a strong password, keep away from pedophiles, make sure that you log out after a session and remember that there's no such thing as a tree octopus, the end. For us, we're really breaking down a lot of those social and emotional skills and thinking about how do you represent yourself? How do you see yourself and how are you sharing that? How do you disagree with someone without personally attacking them? How do you look at someone else's point of view and understand they have a right to that without you tearing them down? And then how am I critical of information? How am I evaluating whether or not it's reliable? How am I then keeping myself safe in a way that suits my needs and that I understand my settings to be able to make choices before things go wrong without expecting them to?
That's awesome. Carla, hi. Blake,
hi.
I just have one question. What is a tree octopus?
So you're an Aussie, so you might know the drop bear. So the Pacific Northwest tree octopus is this fantastic resource teachers use to teach about reliability of information online. So it's a page where, like, save the Pacific Northwest tree octopus, and there's all this information about it and sort of photoshopped photos, and the students look at it and you're like, oh, what could we do, you know, how could we save this octopus? And there's very few students who will challenge you and say, in a tree, an octopus, like, how does that even work? Like, this doesn't appear to be reliable. The Aussie version is the drop bear, and it's gold because apparently there's these ferocious koala bears that don't like people who don't have an Australian accent. And when you walk in the bush, they will drop from a tree and attack you.
It's true. I've seen them. So, that's awesome. So just on the program, it sounds like really what you're doing is going that next step is to say, well, we're not just going to use policy. We're actually going to look at the educational problems and try and address those, which are really social problems, the way I see it. Like, if I think about digital citizenship and one of the struggles that we have and that a lot of schools have, it is around the kind of policy side of it, the, you know, don't do this, don't do that, and us telling you. And when we talk to kids, we hear the same things. The same things are echoed in our school of, oh, we don't need another guy with gray hair telling us how to be safe online. Like, you know, I think we know better is the other thing as well. And I think there's a bit of give and take there in that we have the benefit of a bit of wisdom in the space a little bit, but they have the benefit of the context and understanding what, you know, what tools are being used and how things are being communicated with. So I'm interested in how this kind of manifests in the school. Like, is this something you'd run in a session with students over 13 weeks? Is it something the students do, like a peer support thing where they kind of do it together? What's the role of the teacher? Like, how does that fit together?
So it's a great question because we kind of grappled with all of this right from the start. So the first thing that we wanted to do was that we didn't want to come in and do a one-off workshop. So what we noticed here in New Zealand is that we had schools that really wanted to support their students but didn't know how. And so what they did is they paid really good money to have someone come in to an assembly. And whether that was someone who would scare them, like, you know, ex-detectives, or whether that was someone who had a puppet, lots of puppets, or whether that was someone that was, you know, hugely entertaining and they'd speak in the assembly and people would be inspired or afraid or they'd be talking. But if I asked them 3 to 4 weeks later what the presentation was about, they couldn't tell me if it was about drugs or if it was about cyber safety or if it was about safe relationships. So our approach said we didn't want to be a one-off. So our programs are every 2 weeks for a year, and they're delivered by a community facilitator that works in partnership with the teacher, but is very much there to be another port of call for those students, someone they can confide in, someone who is not seen as a teacher, someone that might drop the occasional slang word, no F-bombs, I promise, but, you know, we talk about not being a dick and what does that actually mean? And we talk about things that other young people have shared with us. So it's real and it's relevant. We're seriously uncool, so we're not those really good edutainment people that come in and rap and you know, pop and lock and people think it's amazing, but we can straddle that relationship, which is very different. So we've got programs for year 5 and 6 students, which focus on kindness, friendship and empathy. And then we have a year 7 and 8 program, which then builds into resilience, perspective taking, assertive communication, standing up for yourself and others, and then also understanding your place in the world and who you are. And then when we get to high school, rather than having a fixed program, the young people identify what it is they want to learn and what that can look like. And this year and last year, working with Facebook, we launched an augmented approach where we go in and do a full-day workshop with students and then we support them with an online opt-in program afterwards. So that's the way that we've chosen to do it, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good model. I think my daughter Kelsey went with you on a trip and did a couple of those seminars and really enjoyed it and came back buzzing, seeing very different approach to how it's done. I mean, it's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to be immersed in it and to see it. And I think it's really interesting. You've obviously taken a risk putting the power in students' hands in a sense, because I guess one of my questions would be, can you really trust these students? Like, at the end of the day, they're the problem. And yet, at the same time, you're also asking them to be the solution. So what does that look like?
Well, I mean, I have to be really honest, and I'm, you know, I am an old person and I get it, but I think we're more of the problem than young people are. You know, you only have to spend 5 minutes in the comments section of a major news website to know that they're not 14, 15, 16-year-olds or 10-year-olds making those comments. So from the start, I think we're more of the problem than young people are. But the other thing, I think young people will always rise to our expectations. So if we expect them to need us to write their passwords down and put it on a lanyard and glue it to their forehead, then they'll do that. If we expect them to come up with a way to remember their password and how they're going to engage when someone on Roblox sends them a comment that they find offensive, they'll rise to that. And I think what's huge is that we work in a small group environment where those quieter voices have a chance to share their ideas. When we think about digital citizenship from a whole class context, you're going to continue to hear the voices of those kids that have the confidence, and you're never going to hear the voices of the kids who don't. So by putting the power in the hands of young people to work in small groups and that they know that their experience is valued. I have been asked, you know, they're not totally polished presenters, you know, like they couldn't keynote an event. Like, do you not have a script? Should these young people not all follow a script? And for us is no, you know, that authenticity is key. You know, your daughter Kelsey sitting there and sharing a story about a really dumb thing that one of her mates did online and how they had to pick up the pieces of it was going to be far more memorable and far more relevant to students that she's working with than, you know, one of those wonderful PSAs that come out in the States, I hate you, you're so dumb, and then people think that that'll never happen to me. So yeah, we've got a really high trust model, and we've never been let down. We've been let down by adults. We've been let down by adults that ask us to be part of things and then want our young people to leave so that the grown-ups can talk, and find it quite challenging when we say that's not how we work, but we've never been let down by our young people.
I'm not surprised by that at all. But just on the community side, it strikes me that this is a very like social problem, and a lot of social problems in schools tend to have a heavy relationship or correlation with the parents. So how does this program kind of, you know, like if they're learning all these new skills at school and they're with their peers and everything, and then they go home, jump online and their parents are there, and does that kind of separate their experience at all? Do they feel like when I go home, I'm going to act differently? Like, how do you kind of transcend that barrier as well?
We have a lot of conversations about it. That's step one. And that's not a curve away from your question. But what's interesting is we have 8-year-olds say, my mum is always on her phone, always. And if I want any attention, I have to physically get the phone and remove it for her to pay attention to me. So we have young people being more aware of not only their own habits, but their parents' habits, and asking questions like, can I have your full attention? Something happened and I really want to talk to you about it. Mm. We had one of our high school girls who said she had to put her mum's phone in a lockbox, run her a bath, pour her a glass of wine and banish her to the bathroom so that she could have some downtime and take a step back from what was happening online. So we really encourage our students to go home and take their activity books home and say to mum and dad, hey, we were talking about self-talk today, and the voice in my head when things aren't going completely to plan says, you're a failure. What does your self-talk say? And opening up those discussions. The other thing that we do to answer your question more properly is that our young people run workshops for parents, and they choose the activities that they've found the most helpful, and they sit the parents down in small groups and they take them through those activities. And that has been one of the most profound changes that we've seen. When you've got an 11-year-old sitting there with 5 or 6 parents and saying, do you know the difference between something that's bullying, something that's rude, and something that's mean? Can you give me examples? Because when you don't understand, you make it harder for us.
I feel like those parents are probably the ones that are volunteering to go to a seminar, probably not the problem though. That's the struggle with these
things.
Well,
it's funny that you say that, Blake. We always have food, which is obviously a real draw card. And because the young people are running the workshops, then they're saying, you have to come. Because that I'm running a group and I've worked hard and I've planned this activity and you need to come, rather than come and listen to Dr. blah, 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 talk on a stage. So we do get a higher attendance rate than at typical events, yeah.
Oh, that's really clever. Just on the, my data-driven brain is kind of trying to process this a little bit. How, you know, you've had great success with Google, and you just mentioned working with Facebook there as well in it kind of sinking in with the wider community, not just the educational, but the corporate world as well. What's the outcome that you kind of see? Like, what is it that you're able to kind of measure in this, in when you run these seminars? What's the outcome? What's the thing that you can come away with and sort of point to, like, that's going to convince people to get on board with this kind of a program?
Totally. So we measure two things. We measure an increase in skills and an increase in confidence. And for us, those two things are critical to creating change. With one and not the other, then change is less likely to occur. So if we do a one-day event, we say, you know, do you feel more confident to understand what bullying is and the part that you play in reducing its impact? And do you feel you have more skills to do that? So for us, success is, have they got increased skills and have they got increased confidence? Now, the difference between a one-day, you know, six-hour event compared to a full-year program is vast. But the feedback that we receive is strikingly similar, which is interesting. We've got, you know, 10-year-olds who say, I felt really bad about myself, and so I tried to feel better by making other people feel small. And being involved in this program has changed the way I look at who I am, and it's changed the way I treat other people. We've got young people who are like, I get what bullying is. We had one 9-year-old, it was hilarious, and the parent said, well, I will not have you being bullied. And the kid goes, can't really call it bullying, mum, because it's a one-off and there's not really a power imbalance because, you know, we're in the same year and the same size, and like I'm not feeling like I can't stop this on my own. So we can't really call it bullying. So you just need to be careful about your language. And mum goes, you know, okay. So those kinds of things are definitely changing. Evaluation is really important to us. We do research with over 1,500 young people every 2 years to identify trends, issues and opportunities, as well as norms. And we're also doing some external evaluation this year to find out, you know, are we achieving the impacts we want to achieve? If so, what are they? If not, why not? And how do we need to pivot? So I'll have a very data-driven answer for you by the end of the year.
That sounds great. I mean, some kind of long-term, I'm just thinking like a revisiting in 12, 18, 24 months would be really interesting to see what happens, because no one's doing that. Like that's one of my gripes with all this digital citizenship stuff. Even if it is well-intentioned and we're looking at, you know, the correct language and following up with kids, no one's then going back in 2-3 years and saying, what are your behaviors now? What do you accept as normal? What do you do when someone, you know, harasses you online or you have a difference of opinion? I don't think that's happening at all. It's sort of this one step deliverance, do it, tick the box, move on, which is unfortunate, but it's also, you know, part of the fabric of schools. That's how schools operate, isn't it? We book the sessions, put people in the theater, and then we move on. So it'd be great to hear about that. Maybe we'll have to revisit in 12 months or something and see where you're at.
I think the other thing that really shows us the impact of our work is that young people stay involved for years and years and years in our program. So when we think about those original 30 young people that set up Sticks and Stones in 2013, over half of them are still involved now. And they have finished university and they're in the workforce, and they're still on our Facebook page and offering suggestions and voting on merchandise and choosing slogans and key messages. So when we think about the impact of truly being part of something they made, it's not a fly by night, I'm in it for a year, see you later. You know, these young people are still involved in their 20s. And for us, that shows us that it's making an impact as well. When I'm at the supermarket, now we're in level 2, when I'm at the supermarket buying fruit, and a young person who was involved in our programs 2 years ago says, hey Carla, how you doing? What's happening with Sticks and Stones? I still remember when we did X. And when we have young people who come to us when things do go wrong, because they know they can and that we will help them through, then that shows the impact as well. So yes, we want to be able to measure it, but at the same time, anecdotally, we know that those relationships matter, and they matter when some pretty terrible and horrific things happen that we've supported young people through. And we also know that we keep them involved for a really long period of time, which is very different to a lot of youth-based organisations.
I think it's important. I don't want people to miss, because I mean, I've spent a fair bit of time trying to get my head around how this runs, because it is different, let's be honest. And when you say like they're voting on merchandise and slogans, like this really is student driven, right? And not just student driven. This is student designed from the ground up. It's not bringing in a cohort of students and getting them to tick off on a whole bunch of work that the adults have done. And then we put a, you know, slap a label on it and say student centered or student involved. Like you, you really do let them design from the ground up, right?
Yeah, we do. And it takes a really long time and it's incredibly messy and loud and disorganized. And you will always hit the wall when you think there is no way we are ever going to do this. We co-designed a online support tool for young people, and that took 2 years from the original idea to the launch of the web app. And there were points where you were just like, there is just no way we can ever make this happen. And not only did it happen, but the simplicity, intuitiveness, and ease of this app is something that no adult could ever have done in the same way. Not to say they couldn't have done a great job, of course they could, but in the way that that was done and the way that young people have engaged with it, and you know, it's won an award and young people are into it and the decisions that they made are so important. And yeah, it'd be a lot easier to get a group of adults in the room and make them decisions, roll it out and put it to a brain's trust and get them to put the okay on it. But it would never get what we've got.
So interesting. Where do you see this going? I mean, you attend a lot of digital citizenship conferences, anti-bullying conferences, events run by government organizations, all of that sort of stuff. Do you see a trend into 2021, 22? Like, what are you seeing on the horizon of things schools maybe need to start thinking about, planning for, and so on?
I think the key trend that we've noticed that probably started kicking off at the end of 2018 was a move away from student consultation to an expectation of student involvement. Now, that hasn't reached the student agency goal that a lot of education departments are talking about and really pushing, but we're moving far more in that direction. We've got the Children's Commissioner here in New Zealand that's saying, you know, there shouldn't be programs run in schools without the voice of young people being a part of it. We've got the Race Relations Commissioner saying the same thing. You've got organisations around the world moving away from one-off workshop models to a more ongoing approach. And we've definitely moved away from the fear-based model to a more education and skills-based development, which I think is really important. So they're really positive trends. The negative side of it is that internationally, these programs typically have been centrally funded by government, and when they're not, they stop. So there's definitely some friction between governments wanting to put a program in place that will change the way that young people experience being able to be themselves free from bullying, harassment, and any kind of racism, homophobia, or any other issues that come through there. But when government funding's removed, so the most evidence-based bullying prevention, online or offline, in the world is out of Finland. When it was centrally funded in Finland, it was in over 85% of schools, and the government pulled their funding, that halved.
Wow.
So the trend's more student engagement, but and wanting more long-term, but a move away from centrally government-funded programs. So what does that look like to be able to survive?
That's super, super interesting how that tied in, yeah, centrally as well. I wonder, what do you say to people who sort of look at this from a broader lens and say, well, okay, well, these aren't new problems. They're just existing, you know, social, emotional problems that people have always had. It's just now being manifested online. So, you know, we never used to do anything. Why do something now? Like what's the incentive for a school to actually do this? Obviously it's going to, you know, protect people to a degree, but rather than just letting them figure it out themselves, why do this program at all? Why do digital citizenship in any form if it isn't just, you know, to reduce the risk on the organization?
I think because the impact that any kind of harassment or bullying in an online or offline space has is second only to family violence in terms of negative mental health impacts. So if you're talking about the crisis that we have internationally with the mental health of our young people that is carried into adulthood, then if we're hoping young people will sort it out themselves, then what we have is young people taking that baggage into their adult lives and continuing those trends and norms. And then it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So there's that, Michael laugh, you know, Brené Brown says, we either attend to fears and feelings now by you having a reasonable amount of time to do it, or we commit all of our time later to dealing with the mess and the fallout of not doing it. And that's completely true of this. If we're saying, oh, you know, when are we going to fit this in? We've got a crowded curriculum. What does this look like? Surely they're just jumping on whatever platform they're doing, and we're asking them to do it well, and we've got filtering in place, and, you know, we've got that, you know, that awesome online program we do for 3 lessons. Is that enough? But what we're doing is we're setting up the habit and norms for a lifetime. And we only have to look at the world now to understand the impact that that has, and not only on our mental health, but on our sense of community, on our connection, of our way to interact and engage with one another. So if we're saying, hey, let's hope they sort it out for themselves, then what we're setting up is, yes, yeah, setting up a road to getting what we've always got.
Mm. Yeah. And that ties into, like, as well, in the more short term, in terms of people coping with stress and anxiety at school around, you know, taking exams and all those kind of day-to-day things as well. And I think there's a Peter Drucker who has a similar quote around, you know, 1 hour of planning saves 10 hours of headaches later. It's sort of that same idea, isn't it? We want to lay foundations now that can be built upon, you know, build on the shoulders of giants, rather than having to, you know, slowly figure all this out into your adulthood. And I know that's how most of us have probably had to do it. You figure out all your shortcomings into adulthood, and, you know, and it's extremely difficult when you're old and you're set in your ways. But I think kids are, you know, they're obviously naturally able to be more resilient and, you know, make change in their life a little easier than perhaps we can.
And they transfer those skills to Blake, which is super cool. So I had a 17-year-old say to me yesterday, you know, I had this random guy on my TikTok and he made a comment about my dancing that was just, you know, not okay. So it just made me go back into my settings and work out who did I want to follow me on TikTok, and how did I want to take control of this. So, you know, transferring skills from one platform to another and not waiting until crisis point, saying, hey, this happened, made me a little bit uncomfortable. What are the steps I can take, rather than waiting for everything to go wrong?
So from a policy point of view, like, do you think that this whole anonymous internet, you know, that we started with, where no one, everyone had a handle, you know, everyone had a pseudonym rather than the real name, we moved more towards now people's Facebook accounts relating to them directly. Are you a proponent for everyone being themselves online, or do you still think that there's a place for that anonymity and, you know, being able to have a sandbox where you can experiment?
I think if there's anonymity, then there needs to be a shared protocol for how you behave. So we've got young people who are part of some really incredible forums and online communities where they use handles, and that might be in relation to their sexuality or gender. It might be in relation to their interests or their culture. But the protocols and the way they behave in those environments are agreed on, and everyone in there is singing from the same hymn sheet, for want of a better cliche. So there's a place for that anonymity, so long as you've got some expectations around how you'll behave and interact with one another. Because sometimes that is where our young people can be their truest selves. You know, under the cloak of Red Riding Hood 86, they can explore who they are and have a sense of community. That said, when we talk to young people around how they behave when they are using their real name compared to when they're using a handle, they say it's vastly different. So we've gone through 3 major anonymous social networking sites since 2013, and each one of those has folded under pressure related to cyberbullying and online harassment and harm. So yes, I think there's a place for it, so long as your expectations and your protocols exist to keep people safe. But at the same time, our young people are very honest about, if my name's associated with it, I'm more thoughtful about what I say.
And I come, years ago, I used to play competitive gaming. And the game that I played was called Counter-Strike, and it's actually got a reputation for being one of the most toxic environments online, because you all get put into what they call a server, 5 versus 5, and your 5 people on your team often are randomly selected, but you can join, you know, 5 people you know and go into a server. That's great. But for those people who are isolated, maybe don't have many friends, they're already, you know, potentially more at risk going into these games on their own. And then you go in with 4 other people. Sometimes those 4 people know each other and gang up on you. Sometimes they just criticize you the entire game and bring you right down. And I know, I remember feeling terrible after games sometimes, feeling like I'd let the team down. things like that. And you can see how that can become an extremely toxic environment. And you don't know who any of these people are, and they don't really know who you are. But I wonder, you know, how that's going to change in the future. Do you see a trend with that? I mean, it'd be hard to sort of have a game full of 14, 15-year-olds with their real names as well. That would be a problem as well.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things we hear from teenagers particularly is that they're not given the opportunity to practice this before they're in an environment where it's for real. And I know that's a weird way to explain gaming, but we haven't had the conversations. We haven't really practiced what this looks like. And then, you know, when we want to impress, you know, we want to fit in, there's not true belonging in a gaming environment because they don't actually know who we are. And so how do we do that? We try and find commonalities, or we try to find, you know, who are we against? And then let's share that in the most toxic possible way. The other thing that we hear from girl gamers is that it's a really misogynistic environment as well. You know, if they find out that you are a female in that environment, then things turn pretty quickly and some of the things that are said are pretty horrific. But that comes back down to, you know, what are our expectations and you know, what do the other people say? Do they join in? You know, what do you say when you see that? Is that somewhere you want to be? You know, weighing up all of those things. My son is 8. He's just started playing Roblox and he told me today, "Mum, you know that person who told you there were really mean people in Roblox who said mean things to one another? They were totally lying. Everyone's super nice." And I'm like, "Okay, who have you been playing Roblox with?" "My friend Max and my friend Blake." I said, "Excellent. Why do you think your friend Max and your friend Blake are nice to you?" He goes, "Well, because they're nice to me in person." I said, "Yeah." So we start to break that down and have that conversation. But for so many of these teenagers, they're getting into this gaming environment. It's hyper competitive, you know, like you don't want to die and have to respawn and not be able to succeed in your mission and have the 11-year-old in Taiwan on their headset start cursing at you for failing your team. We need to be able to think about what our expectations are and have those conversations. And that's really hard when a lot of parents have got no idea what it involves at all and cannot share your grief about not being able to find your precious material in Minecraft or someone coming in and messing with your agent. If your parents like, "Whatever, eat your chicken," then how are they working that through and how are they able to be able to learn what to do next time?
Because it is real. It is real for them. And I mean, I know myself, you're playing a game and you're the last one left and you know those four other people are watching what you're doing, you know, and going to be critical of you. And then the stress level can go up and it's easy to think, "Oh, it's just a game. It's just a game. It's easy. You know, we don't need to worry about that. Just get over it. Let's come to dinner, eat your food." So, you know, I think there is a disconnect. And I think parents would be horrified if they heard the way that, particularly like you mentioned, females get treated in these games. You know, they get threatened with rape and all sorts of things in a way that is not joking. It's very cutthroat and aggressive. And I don't think the people who are saying that, I don't think that makes them necessarily bad people. I think they just feel as though this is a sandbox environment where my words have no impact. They're not going to hurt. They're just me spouting off things, trying stuff, bouncing ideas. It's like the little sandbox where they can try out what it's like to be a bit of a prick.
So and the norms that are established there, you know, like,
yes.
If you think about comparing a press conference in the US to press conferences in other parts of the world, what are the norms that have been established about how the politicians speak to the reporters and how the reporters speak to the politicians? The gaming environment is the same. You know, what are the norms that are there? If you've got a norm that someone, you know, makes a joke about violence and then other people kind of laugh or just let it go, then that's going to be continuing. But if you've got the norm where that happens and people are like, you know, "No, like, out you go," then that's going to change as well. There's some really interesting research done about 3 years ago as well about the hyper focus of gaming and how when you ask a child to stop playing, even if you've given them that awesome 5 minutes, 4 minutes, you know, whatever you're doing, their brain experiences trauma. the same kind of trauma that they would experience from being physically hurt. There's no difference in the trauma that the brain experiences by being asked to leave a game. So the advice was that you sit beside your child and you're like, hey, tell me what's happening. You know, who's that guy? What's happening with that? You know, what's happening there? And open up that environment that you expect to be able to sit down with your child and say, hey, what's happening there? Who's that? What's the mission? What's going on? And get them out of that state of hyper-focus. They're less likely to experience trauma. They're more likely to get off the device in a way without the kinds of huge tantrums, which I know I've experienced, because it's a traumatic shift away from that focus with the rewards and the instant gratification. That if, as parents, we're putting in those kinds of strategies, if your child's expecting that mum or dad would sit down and be interested in what you're playing, then we're kind of moving away from you having a norm where you might be like, you know, I'm going to do X or you're a this, changing the way that it looks.
So it sounds to me like you're advocating for us to annoy our children. Is that what you're saying?
Totally am. Who's that? What did you build? What's happening there? What happens if I press this button? Yeah.
No, I'm all for that. That sounds like a good strategy. I mean, I see it in my kids who are, you know, only 3 and 4 years old, and they're just, well, 2 and 4 years old, I should say, but they just get transfixed by TV, you know, by TV watching. And if they're on their iPad where they have control over the YouTube, it's even worse. They get that instant hit. I want that one. Boom. They click on it and they get that video straight away. It's like a very small form of gaming. And we find dragging them away from the iPads almost every time was causing huge tantrums. So we just stopped with the iPad. They couldn't handle it. So the TV was a lot better and able, you know, and I noticed if we sit and watch and ask questions about the show and stuff, they're far more sociable and they'll move around the room. They might jump on and play with their toys and stuff. Whereas if they're left to their own device, which honestly, sometimes you have to do, and then you try and drag them away, it's very, very difficult.
And I think we get a lot of parents saying things like, you know, I can't get my child off their device. You know, they're spending 8 hours a day gaming. You know, it's about setting up those habits early. And I totally agree. My daughter was 4 when she told me to comment below and hit subscribe to something that was happening at the dinner table. And, you know, coming into that expectation, you know, we've said to our kids, have your devices for learning during the week. You can have devices for playing in the weekend, because they needed that clarity. They needed to know when they could do either. And without it, it just became, yeah, a whole lot of really negative, like I'll go with negotiation, and it became really hard. Whereas when we sit there and, like I say, you know, you're allowed it for this time and this is what we can do, and you sit down beside and you draw them out, that is incredibly important. And the modelling that we do is just massive. You know, we're saying to kids, you know, no iPads or no devices for anything other than learning during the week. And then we're playing Angry Birds or, I don't know, Words with Friends or whatever it is that we're playing there while they're not allowed to use it. So our modeling is massively important. And so many of us as parents are hyper connected and yet expecting our children to not be.
Yeah, and that ties into them setting their own limits as well. And that, I guess that's where your program would be so scary for people, is that our experiences as parents is that kids can't self-moderate, especially younger kids. Like, I think as they get into their high teens, they can self-moderate. Whether they want to or not is another question. But you certainly see it at year 7 when students first come into the school. They have no, like, the doors are opened into high school and suddenly have all these freedoms in high school. And like, there's no concept of self-moderation. They've never had to exercise it. And I think it is a little different in New Zealand schools from what Mike's been saying, where there is a bit more self-direction and they have to have time management skills and things like that. I think in traditional schooling, if we call it traditional schooling, you don't have to do time management. There's a bell that goes every period. There's a teacher that tells you, okay, we're closing our books, we're moving on to this next thing. I think that's changing. I certainly see it changing even in my childcare and kinder programs, where they're saying, you guys have to manage your own time. You're going to have your own little project works to do. And they're starting to build those skills in at a very small level, really young. But I suppose that's the concern you can see from the outside, is that parents are going to think, well, my kids can't moderate, so how much should I moderate? Like, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that, especially as at a teenage level where it gets really real for them. What is the moderation level you would advocate for? You know, should you be taking them off certain things, or weekdays, weeknights, an hour on, an hour off? What do you think is the best practice?
I think that one of the things that comes to us is that we tend to operate the same expectations for a 13-year-old that we do for a 17-year-old. So it's key that it changes with age. That's the first thing. So we often hear things about no phones in the bedroom, and that will totally work for a 13-year-old. But if you're talking about a 17-year-old that may or may not be in your house the following year and will need to self-manage that in a university or work setting, then you need to give them the chance to practice that. And then the other thing, and I know there's going to be parents who hate me, but having the conversation that says, what do you think is fair? Let's actually negotiate this. When you've got a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old, and say, hey, these are my rules, and this is why. Like, I still say to my kids, this is why we ask you to only have the iPad for learning during the week, because we've noticed that all of these arguments, your moods were getting really hard to manage, you're getting angry and upset, and then we were finding we were just not having great conversations with you because we were shouting and you were upset. So this is why we've changed this rule. If you want to talk to us about negotiating a different rule, then yeah, we're up for it. But this is why we've made that decision. So from that younger ages, being really clear about why you make those decisions and choices is really important. And then being open to have the conversation. My son was gutted to go back to school this week because he could do all of his schoolwork in an hour when we were in lockdown. And then he does not understand what he has to do in the other 4 hours at school. So we talk about that self-direction. He was able to look at his program for the week and say, today I'm doing my week's worth of maths. Boom. Doing it for an hour, my maths is done. Tomorrow, oh, that writing thing looks hard. Mum, I'm going to need you. I'm going to need you at 9 so we can do the writing together so it's finished. We need to provide opportunities for them to make choices the same way that my 5-year-old in her play-based classroom has to choose between the provocations that are there, because she's got to, if she leaves that, she has to tidy it up and have it ready for the next child to come and engage with. What are the choices that they're making and what are the expectations we're putting in place? Because so many teachers found during lockdown, everything was directed by them. Their control was paramount. Lockdown changed that. And it was them that found it harder to cope than the kids.
That's a really interesting observation, hey? That it was them who struggled the most. And I think we're starting to see that in some emails that are coming in and around, okay, so schools are starting to think about coming back. How do we keep that student choice in our programs? What does that look like moving forward? Maybe we could get you back, because I know, Carla, you've got some great ideas around that and running student boot camps and around technology use and digging into numeracy and literacy. It's not just the sticks and stones stuff that you do. And maybe we could talk around how do you actually co-construct a curriculum with some students. I know you've done some work with some schools around that, where it's not the teacher saying, here's the program and here's the curriculum and you'll do this today and this tomorrow. But what does that look like for the students to have a say in that? And not just giving them what they think is a say, so that you've pat them on the head and say, there you go, I gave you a voice, but actually letting them choose and the risks and rewards of that. I reckon that would make another great podcast down the track.
Totally. And letting them take their learning beyond you as the teacher. Mm. You know, who else has the expertise and knowledge that you don't have? And how do you engage them with those people? You know, really, we keep talking about beyond the four walls of our classroom, but we desperately want the kids to stay within those four walls because it's easier. So what does it look like to push beyond those?
Yeah, we got a voicemail from a Maori immersion school. I might save that for next week. We were going to play it this week, but just looking at the time. But they're saying exactly that. Students are coming back, but we're looking at how do we give those elements of choice to the students and not have us direct everything, and just taking the best of both worlds, really. I think there's a massive opportunity to do that, not just in our curriculum, but like what you've been talking around, digital citizenship, you know, online safety and just being a good citizen, regardless of the digital part. There's definitely skills for life in that. It's really interesting me listening to Blake drill you, because I've had the pleasure of being able to do that, and it's just been nice to sit back and start to spin and questions start to come.
I just wouldn't mind just throwing a word of caution in around coming back and asking the kids what they would want in terms of self-direction, because one of the things that we've noticed is we train kids, especially in the seniors, like 10, 11s and 12s, they've been trained for 10 years or, you know, 9 years on not to have work, you know, delivered to them. And I think one of the things we've done is we've actually done similar surveying and focus groups with kids around, you know, how did you find this immersion program, say year nine, where there's much more freedom and they can pick modules and they work on their own, they do a bit of inquiry learning and things like that. And the biggest feedback we get is, and this is at year nine, is that there wasn't enough structure. I wasn't being told what to do. And the first thing a teacher says is, oh, that's something I can help with. Let's scaffold, you know, let's scaffold, scaffold, scaffold. And so I think you've got to be a little careful, because I'm definitely in the camp for more self-direction and giving kids the, you know, rather than managing students, informing them, giving them opportunities to extend themselves to go to that next level or to catch up and work in their own timeframes. But I think we've got to be careful about asking kids that have been indoctrinated for 10 years to make a decision about, would you like more structure or less? Well, if all you're used to is structure, of course you're going to want the structure. So,
and I think it also comes back to the feedback that we give. I taught gifted learners for 6 years. And the one thing that my job was to train them out of was them saying, Carla, is this good? And I'd say, I don't know. Is it? And they'd have to explain to me whether or not they'd met the expectations, you know, what they were doing. You're totally right. There are skills that our young people need before they can move in that direction. And we need to enable that to happen. So if all they want is our affirmation and validation, and whether it's a gorgeous Bitmoji sticker or whether it's a pat on the back, if what they're seeking and what they want from us is that validation, then how can they ever give it to themselves? And if we're not supporting them to develop those skills, then of course they want the structure and of course they want to be scaffolded, because it's easier. And when you've got things that are consistently hard in your life, especially as an adolescent, a tween or a teen, then you desperately want things that are easy some of the time too.
And Mike, you'd see this on a larger scale, where I'm sure you love hearing schools will say, we're student driven, you know, we have student voice and they tell us what we want and we implement it, you know, and usually they're telling you what you want to hear and you implement it. And I think there's a bit of work to be done there to actually unpick things properly and not just do a survey and look at some, you know, word clouds and say, okay, well, everyone seems to want this and we're going with that, is to unpick really, okay, well, what's the motivating factor behind decision making and behind, you know, the way in which you're operating at school, whether it's, you know, how you use your devices in the classroom or whether it's like how periods are structured in the school. I think if you ask students what would they prefer, if they only know structured six periods a day, that's what they're going to give you. So certainly have seen that in a lot of the consulting work I've done, where people would love to tell me how everything's driven by students come first and blah, 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 blah. But really it's just surface level surveying just reaffirms the norms that have already been set. And so that always makes change harder, I think, when you're coming up against that.
And the one crazy thing that you might not believe is true, but is actually true, is that teenagers are the kindest survey takers on the planet. They will look at the question and they will say, what does my teacher want me to say? How am I going to get through this? And they will select that response. So you're so right. Those surface level surveys will get you what you want, because those teenagers and tweens, you know, those students, they are attuned to what you want them to say and they will say it.
It's just another test to pass, isn't it?
Yeah. And it becomes a chicken and an egg scenario too, right? Teachers say you can't give students true agency because they don't know what to do with it and they don't even know what it is. And then the students are saying, well, don't give it to me because, like, we don't actually get it. So, you know, we haven't been trained in it. So, like, yeah, I think we definitely should get you back, Carla, and we should dig into some of these principles, because I know we have these conversations about, okay, so let's go beyond the theory and the nice keynote speeches and talk about, how does this actually work in a classroom up front when it's messy at the coalface? Love to dig into some of those things. In terms of just wrapping up maybe some of the digital citizenship discussions, is there any, like, do you have a 5-point plan or a 3 things that you must consider? Or if a school's okay, we want to revamp our digital citizenship program, where do we start? Where do you point people to?
Okay, the first thing, it can't be a one-off, and please don't bring in a guest speaker, tick that box and think you're done. Because, you know, young people are, you know, overwhelmingly in agreement that it doesn't change anything. The second thing is that your digital citizenship policy should be a living document. It should be done with your students. And, you know, we talk about the fact that most teachers don't even know that they've got one, let alone what's in it, or they're able to read it. So you can't put a list together and ask a 5-year-old and their parent to sign it when they start school and expect it to still be relevant when they're in year 8. So it's a living document. It changes and it evolves, and your young people should be involved in the design and construction of that. And the third thing is, digital citizenship isn't a list of don'ts, and it's not only about being online. It's about the skills, confidence, and behaviours that are going to support you to have positive relationships and to be communicating in a way that is thoughtful and considerate.
That's a great place to start.
Yeah, it's great. Fantastic. Should we move on to some wins and fails now, Mike? I think we need to wrap up in a minute. So what's been going on in the news cycle or around the web for you? What's the wins and fails?
Yeah, feel free to join in too, Carla, if you want. I've got a new Asus got delivered by Google this week, a Chromebook. And quite a nice device. I've got it here. Not that you can see it on the podcast, but it's quite good, eh? It's quite fast. It's got an 8 GB processor in it. It handles, it loads fast. It's got a nice feel to it, not like a cheap plasticky Chromebook feel. And I'm actually enjoying getting on it and giving it a whirl. So that for me has been a win in the Chromebook world, is to have something a little bit more higher spec and nice to touch.
That 8 GB processor, Mike, I don't think that exists. I think 8 GB of RAM.
The tech guy, I'm just the tech guy. Yeah.
I'm going to get, if I let that go, I'm going to get destroyed on Twitter. So, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, there's a whole raft of them coming out now for the start of the US semester. So this is kind of prime time for new CPUs, new Chromebooks, new PCs, new everything. So if you're ramping up your end of year stuff, the next couple of months is the time to get some demo devices for next year's BYOD or whatever it is you run at your school. So yeah, we're looking at that at the moment. And that's another thing, speaking to our suppliers, if you are looking at BYOD for 2021, you know, purchasing late this year or early next year, you want to start doing that now. All the indications are that coronavirus has slowed everything in terms of the Chinese supply chain. So making sure you're getting on that now, getting those demo devices in the next couple of months and making a decision by August, so you've got time to order, you know, wait the 10 weeks from China and get your devices in the country. So that's a little tip I heard from our supplier. So hopefully that helped some of us.
It's not a sales tactic either. Like, we got the last stock, and we work with resellers across Australia and New Zealand. We were searching high and low for some decent devices, and we got like the last 7 that were available.
So yeah, it's like 10 plus weeks wait at the moment, and just keeps going up and up. So I'm not sure what will happen there, but we'll soon see. In terms of my win, we have discovered this thing in a computer game, of all things, after talking about how toxic computer games are. Assassin's Creed, I don't know if you guys know that title, you've probably seen it around, is a kind of historic computer game in a way where you'll go back to, like, I think one of them was set in Venice, one of them set in Egypt. And they're running educational tours, like a tour mode in there, where you go into the game and it's actually historically somewhat accurate. So things are in the places they're meant to be in, and they'll show you, you know, the pyramids and the Sphinx, and you can go around and it's all, you know, super high def, top of the line graphics and everything. And I think because of all these travel bans, it's become a real thing for, you know, people actually wanting to go on field trips with their kids. They can't go to the German exchange anymore. So, you know, this is the next best thing. So definitely check that out. It's Assassin's Creed Origins Discovery Tour Educational Mode. If you Google that, you'll find it. And I think you can sign up and dial in or something, and then they'll like take you through a video call style thing through the experience. So very cool, and a great way to, you know, virtually get out of the house and travel overseas, because I don't think any of us will be doing it for a while.
I can echo that, Blake. My husband had that experience firsthand. We were standing in Red Square in Russia, and he said, "I've been here before," to which I responded, "Dude, no, you haven't." And then he pointed out everything in the square from one of the Assassin's Creed games, and it was so accurate. He knew exactly where to go, where the underground was, where the public bathrooms were, where Lenin's tomb was, all the entrances and exits from that game. So they are pretty spot on.
Wow. Oh, they are. And, you know, the learning happens everywhere. I remember turning up to Monte Carlo, and I played a lot of racing games as a kid. In those Monte Carlo racetracks, I knew exactly where we were. I could have directed the bus around, which was quite funny. But yeah, it's just funny. You wouldn't have thought about it, but then you put it together in the place, and it's just a nice little boost. So definitely check that out, I reckon. Any fails for you, Mike?
No, I didn't really have any fails this week. I did have another win, though. We took a bit of a risk last week, and we rolled out a new type of professional development, and we've been talking about this all night, right? Including students in the PD. And so we rolled out with one of our resellers in New Zealand, a Microsoft training, and goes for 5 weeks, and the teachers and the students come together and they learn together online, and then they have to implement what they learn in a challenge. And we had like over 100 schools register. There's well over 100 teachers, and then probably 500 students are involved. And the last 2 weeks it's been running, actually, and it's just gone off without a hitch. So it's been really interesting to see a new form of PD where we're inviting the students into that PD and having the teachers and the students learn together and play together and challenge together. So we were like, oh man, this could go either way. And it seems like it's fallen in the right direction. So pretty stoked. We're actually developing a Google version of it right now. We'll be rolling that out soon. So it's been a real win for us this week.
Awesome. Well, my only fail was just around these devices again. We're seeing all these new raft of devices come out, and again with terrible cameras in them. I don't know what it is with Chromebooks and even cheaper PCs, but the webcams are awful. And if you think about the classroom environment, the one thing we want to do is to be able to take photos and do video and these kind of, you know, we always talk about creating rich media and how that never really caught on. No one's actually doing it, because I think the technology we have in the classroom, whilst it's really powerful, often the camera and the microphone, things like that, are letting us down. So I just wish some of the vendors would step up and put a really nice camera in one of these devices, a WorldView camera where you can walk around, take photos, you know, do all those art things. We have to still have digital cameras around. I don't know why in this age, smartphones and things, we can't put a good camera in a laptop. So yeah, that's my fail for the week.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, surely it's not that expensive to do, right?
No, I mean, they're in smartphones, they're in cheap smartphones. If you buy a $200 smartphone, it has a really good camera. But no one's doing it, not even Apple. I think Apple have to take the plunge so that all the sheep will follow and then we'll see it. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Any wins or fails from you while you're here, Carla? Putting you on the spot. You're muted.
The biggest fail today was working with a school that had 20 iPads each with a separate Apple ID and password, and we're trying to manage all 20 iPads to be able to push apps out to their students. So that was one of those awesome factory reset 12 iPads and start fresh to try and work out how they can use them more effectively, move away from 20 apps for 20 different purposes and using them as the tool that they are. So it's kind of a fail wrapped up in some possibilities for a win afterwards.
That's awesome. Yeah, very good. I saw a lot of chat messages going backwards and forwards about MDMs and all sorts of things today. So that was interesting. Yeah, that's awesome. Hey, we've really appreciated you having on, Carla. I want to just thank you for taking time out and sharing what you do. If people want to find out more about Sticks and Stones or to reach out and contact you, what's the best way for them to do it?
So start with our website. So it's www.sticksandstones.co.nz. And then check us out on Twitter. We're Sticks and Stones NZ, and we're Sticks and Stones NZ on Instagram as well. And yeah, we've got a student action pack coming out that we have been co-designing with our young people for Bullying Free New Zealand in partnership with the Ministry of Education. And you would love it if you checked it out. We've worked really hard on it. It's colourful and bright and awesome. It's got some super practical and fun ideas in there. But yeah, get in contact. We love to hear from you, and we're really responsive. So check us out.
Yeah, that's awesome. And Blake and I would love to hear from you as well. There's lots of different ways you can get in contact with us. You can go back and grab the other episodes. And the easiest way to do that is just go to utb.fyi/outclassed. And you'll be able to see all the different episodes we've got there. You'll also see there's a button to leave us a voicemail. And we're stoked that this week somebody stepped out of their comfort zone and they left us a voicemail. We might play that next week if we have time. And you can also use the hashtag OutClassPodcast, and we'll pick that up and be able to see it and be able to interact with you there. So lots of different ways to stay in touch. We'd love to hear your questions as well as your comments and your feedback. And we'd love to be, you know, maybe even feature you on a podcast down the track. So again, thanks for listening. Carla, thanks for being with us. Blake, always good to catch up.
Always. Thank you, Mike. And thank you, Carla. It was fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more episodes and show notes, visit utb.fyi/outclassed.